International.
Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you for joining me. This week, reparations, remorse and redress in Namibia. Germany says it will pay for its deadly sins of the past in colonial times. Is the deal they're offering the Southern African nation enough, or will it spark new conflict? We'll hear from Namibians.
This negotiation is flawed.
I know of some people who are even going as far as saying that we're going to go to war with this one.
As Namibia takes on Europe's biggest economic power for what's been called Africa's forgotten genocide, we'll bring you analysis about what other nations can learn from this moment.
You actually have the Germans where you want them. Don't panic. Get a German lawyer. You're dealing with a government that has centuries' experience in negotiations.
All of that coming up. Straight Talk Africa starts now. History is filled with episode after episode of brutal exploitation of Africa's people. In recent times, some nation states who have perpetrated these atrocities have offered apologies and recompense. In a moment, we're going to examine the latest example unfolding in Namibia. But first, some global context. The reparations debate is raging in America, and previous landmark agreements in the US and Europe have set precedents for what victims and their descendants might expect. VOA's Mariama Diallo explains.
Slavery officially ended in the U.S. in 1865 with the adoption of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. But its effects have persisted, contributing to disparities between white and black populations. Because of this, many say that amends must be made for the wrong that was done, and they are long overdue.
Today we launch Mayors Organized for Reparations and Equity, or MORE. So each of us does something more, makes more of a commitment to justice, more of a commitment to wealth building, more of a commitment to a society that includes everybody, more of a commitment to a country that faces its past because we know our prosperity in the future depends on it.
Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti and mayors of 10 other cities are taking the first step by pledging to pay reparations for slavery to a small group of black residents in their cities.
When I hear about mayors taking a proactive step to provide reparations to people who are injured, it's an acknowledgement that municipalities also participated in the horrific acts that have injured black communities and black people over the course of American history. We did not arrive at a wealth gap where white families have about 10 times the amount of wealth as black families simply because of federal policy, not just because of slavery, but because of Jim Crow racism also and historic discrimination in criminal justice and housing.
Yet discussing the issue of reparations at the federal level has always been partisan political football.
When it comes to African Americans, we say, no, 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 who will pay for it? I didn't own any slaves. And all these lame excuses. Remember, the federal government will pay. We provided reparations for the Japanese in turn. We provided reparations for Native Americans. We've even seen it at reparations given to 9/11 victims. The only time we don't agree with reparations is when it's talking about black folk.
2 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor, which prompted the U.S. entry into World War II, then-President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued an executive order against Japanese Americans.
Many rightfully so call this one of the darkest times in American history, when close to 120,000 Japanese Americans were forcibly removed from their homes on the West Coast and placed into concentration camps scattered throughout the country. But a lot of this was rooted in basically wartime hysteria, the false claims by the government that Japanese Americans were a security threat to this country.
Nearly five decades later, in 1988, Congress passed and former President Ronald Reagan signed legislation that recognized and apologized for the mistake and provided a cash payment to anyone who was interned. Other countries have also acknowledged and paid for their past sins, including Germany and the United Kingdom. As of 2020, the German government has paid more than $80 billion in Holocaust reparations as a result of negotiations with national and international Jewish organizations. In 2013, the United Kingdom apologized and agreed to pay compensation to thousands of veterans of the Mau Mau nationalist uprising in Kenya, which was brutally suppressed by the British colonial government in the 1950s. The Kenyan Human Rights Commission estimated that 90,000 Kenyans were killed or maimed and 160,000 detained. In Kenya, Mau Mau veterans and campaigners welcomed the apology at the time, but said the compensation of 300,000 shillings or about $3,500 per victim was not enough for the pain, suffering, and long-term effects the community has endured, a feeling shared by many victims of atrocities in general. While reparations can come in many forms, some people oppose cash compensation, arguing that any money paid is blood money. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Mariama Diallo reporting there for us. Mariama, thank you. Now to Namibia.
I don't expect anything from this negotiation because they are suspects from day one.
The Germans gave my grandmother hardship. She ran alone. She grew up among foreign people. She was forced to speak a foreign language, and we're living in poverty because of what they did to us at the time. Now we want them to restore our dignity. Reparations must come, and we want our land back.
Namibians expressing their views about their country's negotiations with Germany for reparations over a genocide at the start of the 20th century. Tens of thousands of Namibia's Nama and Herero people died at the hands of German colonizers. Political analyst Jose Riruaco's family has been at the forefront of the reparations fight. 5 years ago, his late uncle, Kuaima Riruaco, then Herero Paramount Chief, pioneered the international call for Germany to apologize and pay up. Now, the moment of success may be near. Berlin is offering Windhoek over $1 billion in reparations. But some say this offer could ignite new conflict, even as Namibia hopes to settle the score for an old one. I spoke to Riruaco recently and asked what exactly does Germany have to atone for?
Exactly in 1884, there was the famous Berlin Conference. Some people say famous, some say infamous Berlin Conference that carved Africa in a number of colonies. It's one meeting that was about Africa, and that was never attended by any African. That's how Namibia got to be occupied by the Germans and became a colony. What the Germans did when they came, they carved one of the biggest area in the country that was more fertile, was blessed with a fertile land. And they also carved that area that had so many mineral resources, in it. And that area, they call it the police zone. That was the area that was inhabited mostly by the Namas and the Hereros. They decided at some point that they have to put up an armed resistance against the Germans. But this was after a very prolonged period of time where the Africans were very accommodating when the Germans came. The Namas at that time were not necessarily involved in the fighting. It was the Hereros. The human fight that followed was so difficult for the Germans to such an extent that they decided to bring more reinforcement and bring a German by the name of Luther von Trotter, who was known to be a ruthless killer, to come to Namibia. And the idea was to make sure that they not only teach these Africans some lessons, but they make sure that they capture as much land as they could for the German. When von Trotter came, he issued the famous decree, the extermination order. So the idea was to exterminate the Hereros from the face of the earth. And part of the extermination order was that those who are not killed should be driven in barren land where they could die from thirst and hunger and so on. Hereros and numbers that were put in concentration camps at the time, a lot of experiments were done on them.
Wir bezeichnen heute diese Ereignisse.
Today we call what happened officially what they were, a genocide. We admit our historical responsibility. And in light of this historical and moral responsibility of Germany, we ask Namibia and the descendants of the victims for forgiveness.
So, Jose, what was your reaction when you heard these words?
I was completely thrilled. Over 100 years, the German never accepted their guilt. They have never accepted the pain, suffering, and death, rape, maiming that they have inflicted on our people. And I remember participating in many discussions, with my late uncle, Chief Riroko, where I served as one of the, as an advisor to him. And I remember many delegations that we took, or even when we went to repatriate the first human remains, which was the skulls from Germany, from Charité University. It was estimated by the Germans themselves at the time that about the population of the Hereros at the time were about 100,000, and they were reduced to a mere 16,000. So meaning that 84,000 were killed. We wanted the German to own their deeds, to acknowledge that what they have done was indeed a genocide. Secondly, after doing that, to apologize in no equivocal terms to the Hereros and the Namas. And then the third thing was to pay a commensurate reparation. And I want to make it very, very clear that the life of the Hereros and the life of Namas are no less than the lives of the Jews. Not only did we lose life, we also lost land, and we also lost moving property. So when we are asking for a reparation, we are not looking for a favor from Germany. And we are not asking something that does not belong to us. Now, this is not, in fact, including another claim that we can lay on the German, which is the loss of our culture, our tradition, the displacement of our people. The one question that I would want to ask the Germans and everybody, or any person of any goodwill, where would you get a culprit, the person who have committed the crime, meting out justice for him or herself? Because the Germans are now playing it all. They are the culprit. But then they say, okay, hey, now we acknowledge we have done something wrong. But now this is how you will punish us. In terms of money, we can only pay you so much. Is there any way in a world where the guilty will decide his fate or her fate?
Do you think, like the repercussions, reparations should happen over generations?
Definitely, definitely. See, companies in Germany got rich because of what they have done in Namibia. Whether it was the cheap labor of those that they colonized, whether it was the mineral ores that they plundered during their stay, or whether it was the wealth that they found there and took. What we are saying is that we are not asking for anything short of what is ours. What we are saying is that you benefited from our misery. If we were to put our wealth and our loss, and quantify it, Germany will never pay it back. It's so much. To answer your question, yes, we think that this is a generational issue. This is something that has affected everything. I'm a Herero, for instance. My participation in any election and performance, had the Germans not come to Namibia and slaughtered 84% of my 84,000 of my people, I may be even one of the dominant tribal or racial group in this country. It is because of that. So it affects each aspect of life.
Now, we're all seeing inside Namibia the fierce debate and all the tension around this matter, with some of the Herero groups and Nama groups saying they feel betrayed and sidelined by the government in these negotiations. Do they have a point, Jose? And if Windhoek goes ahead with this deal and without the blessing of these groups, will that be a mistake? And if so, what will the backlash look like inside your country?
If this deal goes as it is, I think it's going to be a mistake of the century, of this century. I don't think it will augur well with the affected group. I know of some people who are even going as far as saying that we're going to go to war with this one. Whatever we do with these negotiations, let's not leave people without options. That's one thing. And that's the first thing. And then the other thing also, let's make sure that everybody is feel appreciated and included. If there are some groups that think that they need more time for consultation, if we need to do more study, let's give each other time. One will appeal to both the German government. Take time, listen to us more. We are the affected group. We know what we want. You can't be telling us what you think we want. Until such time as we say we have exhausted this issue among all the concerned parties, government, the affected group, the German government, like with the Jews. You have the 23 groups of Jews, you have the State of Israel, you have the Germans, right? We are not ruling out the same approach. That is the approach that we've been following. But what we are saying is that let's not rush. The 1. Something billion that they are talking about, roll over 30 years, this is a joke.
And that was political analyst Jose Riruako speaking to me from Windhoek, Namibia. Now, on social media, we asked whether you think money can absolve past atrocities committed by colonial powers. Zondi Milanzi says reparations may partially handle economic damages. However, some damage is irreversible. Thus, forgiveness on the part of the once colonized is the only sure way forward. Faith Clara from Uganda says, never. Money can't fix the past. It can't bring the dead back to life. Nim Rogers in Uganda says yes to reparations because history is history. We have to move on. And we have the same sentiment here from Katakia Evans Osei Wusu in Ghana, who also says yes to reparations, but our African leaders are so corrupt, it doesn't have the intended impact. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back...
We don't want this to be a missed opportunity.
Do not do what the South Africans did and panic. They were outdone by the apartheid government.
Take a hard look at the world, how it is today, a hard look at Europe, but also a hard look at ourselves.
What Namibia can learn from other reparations deals in Africa. Also, why are some Western nations apologizing now and others not? Back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. We're talking about reparations, remorse and redress in Namibia for what historians have called Africa's forgotten genocide. I invited some great minds from three different countries, Namibia, Germany and South Africa, to ask why some European nations are apologizing now for past atrocities and how Namibians could succeed at securing justice where other nations have not. What a great pleasure it is to have all of you here to talk to me about this. Let's do a quick round of introductions. Penna Brock is a project consultant with the Namibia Institute for Democracy and a transitional justice researcher. And she joins us from Windhoek, Namibia. Joshua Kwesi Akins is a political scientist at the University of Kassel. He joins us from the German capital of Berlin. And we were compatriots in South Africa. Now we are compatriots here in the United States. Piwo Kushle Mnyandu. He He's a joint lecturer in the departments of African Studies and World Languages and Culture at Howard University here in Washington. Welcome to all of you. Pena, I'm going to start with you. Give us a sense of the national mood and impact of all of this talk about reparations in your country. And in your view, is this a moment that will lead to healing or conflict among Namibians?
Well, I think to answer that question in two parts, there's the ideal impact and then there's the impact that I think might be more the reality on the ground. The ideal impact really is for Namibia and Germany to start moving forward in a very constructive way where the past is not just addressed or pushed aside, but it is addressed at all levels. And I think the ideal impact is for us to move forward is not only the material upliftment of marginalized communities or affected communities who are descendants of the genocide, but honest accountability by Germany, forgiveness by the affected communities, and the restoration of their dignity through material upliftment and also symbolic gestures that truly restore the dignity. But I do fear that the ideal version will not be achieved because we have so many issues with power positioning between Germany and Namibia, whereas reparations really supposed to say that you have two parties with different power balances and you're supposed to be bringing it, negotiating at a very like equal level. But I still feel that the power distribution is still asymmetrical between Germany and Namibia. When I interviewed the special envoy, the Namibian special envoy in 2018, he said that there's a lot of power positioning in these negotiation talks. A lot of the time we focus on the end result of reparations, the amount, the figure, but a lot of the time we also need to focus on the actual process, how it's being done, who's being included. We have also a lot of division within Namibia where the Namibian government is opting for a bilateral agreement. And I don't think a bilateral agreement is the right way to go. We're supposed to be having an agreement between the governments as well as the interest groups who actually started this movement, and they're not at the table. So any amount that is brought forward is going to be rejected by a big group of the public because the process itself is not restoring the dignity, is not restoring the power back to the people.
So, Kwesi, that does bring me to this question for you. What is going on in Germany and Europe right now? On the one hand, we're seeing some apologies going on from European leaders, French President Emmanuel Macron apologizing for France's role in Rwanda's genocide recently. Some a little less apologetic, a little more puzzling. The Belgian king sending his regrets to the people of the DRC for past atrocities. But now, Germany. What is behind these apologies we are seeing now?
Yes, so as you have mentioned, there's a kind of a wave, maybe even a rush or a bit of a unfortunate symbolic scramble between European powers to now position themselves as the symbolic leaders of what appears to be very, very symbolic acts, right? So in Germany, you know, we have an election coming up, right? So it seems to be an opportune time to bring these negotiations to a close. And of course, in Germany, we always have to be mindful of the fact that the register in which these negotiations are presented are very much in line with the way in which National Socialism is commemorated, right? So if you listen to politicians here, they're hitting all the right notes saying that this cannot be the final line, you know, under this shared history. We have to take responsibility. We have to acknowledge. So these are, you know, key words that you also hear when it comes to, again, you know, remembering National Socialism and the Holocaust in Europe. However, then if you look at the actual substance of the agreement, you find that there are clauses or, you know, if the government is asked about it, they will actually tell you that this is a document that would make it impossible to seek further legal redress. So there you already see there's a gap, you know, between the symbolic aspect, the ways in which different European powers, France, but also, of course, now Germany, are projecting themselves as taking responsibility for the shared history of violence that is colonialism, right? And then the legal aspect, where very studiously it is avoided to create opportunities to seek further redress. And you see this that in two ways. During the negotiations, certain terms were avoided, right? And now, as we are nearing the culmination of these negotiations, you also see very carefully crafted language that seeks to avoid the opportunity for further legal redress, which then also tells you that this, you know, key language of this not being, you know, the final line is obviously not, you know, fully true, because clearly European powers are attempting to draw final lines. And this is true for the restitution debate. This is true for the reparations debate. And I think, you know, from an African and African diaspora standpoint, what we have to be mindful of is that we have to take care that the symbolic aspect, which is also very important, I don't want to diminish that, is not, you know, too disconnected from the material aspect, right? Because reparations has these different dimensions to it. There is the dimension of symbolic recognition, and there is a dimension of, you know, material recompense. And this is, of course, another issue that you see across Europe, where European leaders and governments are conflating the issue of material recompense with their ideas of so-called development assistance, which from an African angle should raise another red flag, because as we all know from our various, you know, national histories, so-called development assistance comes with conditionalities. Now, of course, if we really want to talk reparations, we must be very, very clear. If somebody acknowledges a wrong and pays recompense, the person who's paying cannot determine what should or should not be done with the recompense. And that means whenever you conflate the issue of reparations with development assistance, you're actually leaving the ambit of what reparations are and should really be about. And so what we clearly see here is there's a bit of a race going on, you know, among European governments to position themselves as, you know, leaders, as the ones who are taking responsibility. And we have to make sure by, you know, critically keeping an eye on these different dimensions that they are actually staying true to what they're claiming they want to achieve, which is, you know, a recognition of that shared history of violence and taking responsibility. So far, I would say none of the European and certainly not the German offer is really going far enough in actually taking responsibility at the symbolic level and also at the material level of recompense.
Pewu Kushle, you and I both know the deal in South Africa. The last apartheid president, F.W. de Klerk, first not apologizing, then he apologized, then he took it back. Here in the United States, the debate over reparations for slavery has been going on so long, and we're no closer really to it actually happening. Why is the issue of reparations always such a political football?
America and South Africa are like twins when it comes to race, power, and victimization over time. So once you start, and in effect, we must pause and give credit to the African-American justice movement that has been taking place in the last 2 years, at least prominently on television and in the media. Because of this, and whenever whatever happens in America often spreads like wildfire thanks to social media. So the Me Too movement and then justice, the BLM, this cannot be ignored as having kind of been a spark that led to this, the prominence of conversations around reparations. Because there was a time in America as late as 2005 when reparations were not even discussed. It was a loser issue during elections. But now it has been transformed to center stage. So thanks to the conversation that's taken place in America, thanks to kind of the BLM movement and similar movements in America, and their spread and this kind of flattening of the surface or of the communication surface across the world, we're having then in South Africa to ask these similar questions that you raised. Like, were we naive when we agreed on Section 25 of property? Right, in South Africa, were we naive when we said, okay, let there be sunset clauses? Because if you're talking about reparations from bottom up, Pena said, that the people must be involved themselves, organic movements, then South Africans have lessons with the advantage of hindsight to glean from this. and kind of jump onto the American example and see what they can do for themselves.
Pena, of course, a lot of this is about the history too, but when one sees the images of people at the negotiating table, it really does make you wonder where the young people of Namibia are. They are the ones, after all, who have to take this into the future. Where do they fit in, and how do they feel about this moment of reckoning in their country?
I think when it comes to the Namibian youth, there is a lot of potential, because of late the Namibian youth has become very vocal and very ambitious, and the Namibian Institute for Democracy has been very keen to work with the Namibian youth. At a government level, we still continue to see the Namibian youth being left out or being kind of plucked in as token youth representatives, but not really having any form of or part ownership over many processes in Namibia. And the same can be said with the reparation movement. The reparation movement is very much the faces and the voices of our chiefs, of our political leaders, of our president. The youth unemployment can also be addressed through reparations, for example. In Namibia, we have high youth unemployment rates and increased violence amongst the youth. You know, when we're thinking reparations, we can be very creative here and think of like exchange programs, educational opportunities, and all of these other, and for them to have ownership, that's the important thing. And I think one of the colleagues here had said that saying, this is what how we wish to spend the reparations, the material upliftment. There's so much potential there. We don't want this to be a missed opportunity. You know, the youth, as I said, very vibrant in Namibia. It's amazing to see that they know what they want, and they need to be part of these talks as well.
To add to this, I mean, looking at this from Berlin, right, from where the genocidal violence was orchestrated, right, I think it's important to note that one of the key issues that is still lingering is, of course, the land issue. I mean, this was a genocide in a settler colony, and the vast majority of arable land in Namibia today is still in the hand of white descendants of those who directly benefited from the genocide, right? Which makes the fact that this is not being addressed fully in the negotiations even more grievous, because at the same time, Germany does actually send support to the, you know, German-speaking diaspora in Namibia to this day, right? I mean, there are German schools that are state-sponsored. There's, you know, German cultural life in Namibia today. Now, I'm not saying that this is completely legitimate. What I am saying, though, is that if we look at this as a shared history, clearly it's very obvious that this, you know, kind of support, this kind of, you know, amplification of voice must also be extended, you know, to all, and also, of course, to African, Black African, Namibian youth, especially those whose families are still impacted by the echoes of the dispossession, right? I mean, we have Herero Nama people who are landless. We have Herero Nama people who don't even live in Namibia itself, but in the surrounding countries. This is still an effect, you know, a lingering effect of that genocide and dispossession. So these are things that need to be addressed, absolutely. And just to add to what has been said earlier, when Pena spoke about who was at the table, right? Looking at this from Berlin, I think it's important to note that when the German government in the 1950s negotiated for, you know, atonement and reparations after the Holocaust, it was possible for the German government to negotiate not just with the government of Israel, but with at least 20, if not more, Jewish diaspora organizations. So there we have a blueprint for what should and could be possible today, right? Now Germany is saying, well, we have to negotiate with the sovereign government of Namibia, when, of course, the boundaries of Namibia itself were created right here in Berlin, right? So literally the colonial frame of the negotiations was literally drawn right here. So now the government in that same city is using that colonial frame to pick and choose who they think they should be talking to. And this shows, you know, again, the colonial echoes in the power dynamics that are tilting the playing field for these negotiations today.
And, you know, in the discussion, Pibokushle, about wealth distribution, I'm always very curious to know what different people think about this. And I asked this of our previous guests, too. The repercussions of these atrocities have played out over generations in many African countries. Given that, do you think that reparations for the past atrocities should also be made over generations?
Oh, certainly. In fact, I would say, far from being about the past, reparations about the future. Because reparations, if it is a moral or material indemnity, as in 1951, Germany paying about 91.1 billion to date. Now, of course, it would be instructive for us, so it would help us to compare 91 billion or the Germans paid to 1.3 billion is the number right now that Namibia is working with. So it is about the future, because it is, if reparations is to fix displacement, economic displacement, loss of life, in other words, this moral and material indemnity, it must, for people to move forward, it must understand then, since it is subjective, in this case, the Namibian people, not necessarily the policy-making elites, must decide what will constitute moral and material indemnity for us. If I was an advisor to the Namibian government, I would say, you actually have the Germans where you want them. Don't panic. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. We have a movement of justice echoing across the world. The fact that Germany is talking to you right now and negotiating means you are actually in a good position. Do not do what the South Africans did and panic and look for a solution just to sign something that you will regret in 10 years' time. So the German, if anything, I'll tell Van Hook, take it easy, get a German lawyer, okay? The South Africans were ahead of themselves. They thought they could negotiate, but our leaders had only debated at university. They were outdone by the apartheid government. You are dealing with a government that has centuries' experience in negotiations, and the Namibians must take a very go-slow approach and learn from others' unsuccessful attempts.
Pena, in Namibia, much like you would find in South Africa, you have the descendants of the victims, essentially living side by side with the descendants of the perpetrators. What is the general atmosphere around that situation in the country right now?
I think the tension is definitely noticeable, and I can say that from a personal perspective and also from research-based. The issues around statues, for example, in Namibia that commemorate German soldiers in public spaces in front of the state house in Swakopmund at the coastal town, there's still German soldiers being commemorated there. And some of the time when these discussions come up every few years, should we not take down these statues? There's almost this panic and this fear of saying, well, you're taking away my history. But we need to also acknowledge what that history represents. And we cannot even get there if, let's say, the German schools in Namibia, if we are not discussing our history, you know. At the end of the day, if I'm being asked to make amends for something that I don't understand, then the amends is going to be fake, you could say. If my education curriculum expands on this shared history, and then the next time someone says, let's take down the statue, I will understand why. Maybe around certain dinner tables, some German descendants will talk about this and say, oh, how can we help? But how do we translate those kind of little pockets into a national platform where I think we can also can also be an apology from German descendants as well. They're also German private companies that previously owned concentration camps during the genocide. And they are just kind of, it's not being addressed. So, yes, we need to have our discussions with Germany, but what kind of national platforms can we create that can really bring about true reconciliation as well? And just to lastly touch on the land issue, the representative of the Herero Traditional Authority, he told me once that some of their ancestral land is owned by German settlers now. And every time they want to pay respect to their ancestors, they have to get permission from German descendants. So you can even understand the sort of indignity that comes with that. And I think overall, we need to look at this as a responsibility to educate ourselves as descendants of Germans, and then from there to engage, not to say, well, this is what I think, this is what I feel. How can we start to really translate that into national platforms and agendas?
And that's one important national conversation. But Kwesi, I'm curious, what is the national conversation in Germany about this? And amongst Europeans in general, is there one? What do they know about the past and their past in Africa? Because at the end of it all, it's taxpayers of today in Germany who have to foot the bill for atrocities that happened a long time ago.
Right. I guess it's a key question. What do people know? And I have to say, unfortunately, fairly little. So these issues are not part of the core national curriculum. So when I went to school here, that was not on the table. So I had to educate myself about this outside school. But as I'm somebody who was also doing political and public education about this, I have to say there has been a shift in recent years where interest has been rising. And I think this is something that has been built up where several global movements have really linked together to create a stronger awareness for the echoes of colonialism in today's life. Looking at Black Lives Matter, looking at the Fallist movements in South Africa, looking at movements against racial profiling and deadly racist police violence in Germany, which is also taking place here. So all these things came together to create a context where especially younger people are asking questions and are demanding to know more. And this also leads to the fact that there is some attention in national media. There is some attention, in the political sphere, where different political parties position themselves slightly differently on the issue. Like I said, it's also election season in Germany right now. So all these things have helped to give this a higher profile. Also, the ongoing debate about restitution of stolen, goods, cultural goods, but also human remains has also fueled this. And then in the German context, we must also say that, of course, the history of the genocide in Namibia, Penna mentioned, the first German officially so designated concentration camps were actually erected in what is today Namibia, and they were erected to contain and to kill Africans, right? So there are links between colonial history and National Socialist history, right? So Germans are very much, raised and invited to critically think about National Socialism. So then we have new voices coming along to say, look, you can't even understand that is presented to you as the original sin of Germany if you don't link it back to history. And that all leads to a groundswell of interest. And now the question is, will it be possible to translate that into pressure for changing the political course of action, right? And so this is, of course, a question, as we've been discussing, there's also a question for the future. And I am hopeful that the voices that are rising now in Germany and internationally will keep speaking up to hold Germany to account. Because what we must prevent is, again, that this current bilateral negotiations lead to an agreement that is very heavy on the symbolism and very light on the material recompense.
If I may chime in, yes. When I read what has come out so far from Berlin, the speeches, I was struck by one phrase that said that we recognize what we recognize today as genocide. Ah, you are somewhere now, okay? What we recognize today as genocide. So when we compare with other reparations or acts of reparations elsewhere, a Holocaust in 1940s is a Holocaust today and was a Holocaust in 1970s, you see. So this is why I'm for caution for the Namibians, and there must be meritocracy in Windhoek. You can't. There must be transparency about who's in the negotiations and a team. So we know these are competent people that won't be outdone. But I wanted us also to zoom out and see this global perspective, where right now we're kind of in a transition to a kind of a multipolarity, where countries that were hitherto not so preeminent are preeminent, and they're preeminent in their outspokenness about colonial deeds. One elephant in the room here is China in Africa. So there is this scramble, which again, I'm saying this to be optimistic for the African perspective, because everyone is vying for to be on the right side with the Africans, because the Chinese are doing some heavy things on the continent that involve, there might be debates about other things, but in, essentially, there is a lot of attention that has been given to the China-Africa relations. And so it's a right moment for the Africans to kind of use some of these things for their benefit, to say, well, if you want to be better than the Chinese or as you, you'd like to be, you need to give us this and that. So there's a global perspective and global forces that are even not of the making of the Africans themselves. But by being smart about how they conduct the negotiations, the Africans can take advantage of these global movements that are taking place.
Okay, so here's my final question for all of you, and we'll do a quick round robin on this. This conversation, of course, is really about accountability. Now, if African nations are to hold Western powers accountable for atrocities committed in Africa in the past, what about today and what about the future? Can we then expect reparations from African leaders and governments who commit atrocities today and from here on forward in their own countries against their own people? I mean, is this going to be what the reparations debate of the future will look like?
If we make a distinction between the international level of reparations, which we have kind of been seized with, but then there's this intranational level of reparations, and then we make a second distinction between reparations, a program with policy, ongoing, comprehensive, legal, it's measurable, and so on and so forth. But these acts of reparations that take place amongst people, Africans are a forgiving people in general, if I may generalize. There have been acts of reparations going on in Rwanda, Kachacha, and so on and so forth, in South Africa, and so on and so forth, where people just said, look, I'm seized with getting a house, living my life, and having my children have school uniform. Hence the importance of leadership. When people are seized with the exigencies of living a normal modern life, leaders must take hold of the affairs of the state. So I would say, yeah, the present is optimistic. The present is here. And if the African governments themselves look at their laws and say, well, which part of this South African law is kind of, it was grandfathered in, if I may, from the apartheid era. And it has led us massacring some miners in 2012 in Marikana. And then protect, and no one has ever gone to jail for that. Is there reparations? And I would say yes. So I wouldn't even put it as an issue of the future. It's already happening from some aspects, organic, youth-driven, and lateral across this media, social media space. And it takes notes from America, from German youth, and from Sweden, and so on and so forth. And I'm optimistic about it. Thank you.
I think this is a key point that was just raised in terms of, you know, grandfathering of laws, you know, colonial echoes in today's African body politic, right? I mean, if we literally look at the borders, at the way states are managed, the way governments are organized, the way police forces are organized, the culture of violence in many African police forces, they are clearly colonial continuities. So in my mind, these things are linked. Now, this is not to let African leaders off the hook in no way, but we have to understand, you know, the structures in which we exercise power, we exercise and normalize violence, right? And I think to get to the root of this, we have to look at colonial history and, of course, African complicity. Let's be very, very clear. No act of colonial violence would ever have been possible without some level of, you know, African complicity. That's not to excuse European violence. It's just to say we have to look at, you know, African agency in the past and in the present. And that's where, of course, one opportunity the debate of reparations grants us is to take a hard look at the world, how it is today, a hard look at Europe, but also a hard look at ourselves through the lens of decolonization. I believe we have to look critically at our power structures. We have to ask ourselves, if we want to reduce violence, if we want to redress the echoes of that lingering history that we are rightfully accusing Europe of, then what does it mean in terms of how we have to change the way we do politics, the way we understand the way in which, you know, this Western-style democracy and those things work together with what we've been discussing earlier, indigenous authority. We've heard about the chiefs. We heard about Gachacha, right? These are not just people in power. These are systems of how to dispense justice in a different way, systems of how to govern land in a different way. And we have to look at the ways in which they are also imbricated by colonialism, of course. These are not pure remnants of some ancient past, but they hold resources that we have to look at more critically. So in my mind, reparations is just one stepping stone on a longer journey of decolonization, and that needs to be self-decolonization as well.
I just wanted to add to that, you know, I think when it comes to these debates of justice, it's not so binary as the white colonial perpetrator and the African victim. And I think once we start to break down that binary construct, can we start to look at things more critically? We need to accept that, especially the role the Namibian government is going to play in these reparation negotiations. That's why transparency is so crucial. It has to be holding our African leaders accountable, and it has to be holding former colonizers accountable for the historical injustices that continue to affect us. So it's not to say one or the other. I think there's more than enough room to address all of these forms of atrocities. It really is about addressing all forms of injustices.
All right, we'll leave it there. Penna Brock in Windhoek, Namibia, Joshua Kwesi Akins in Berlin, Germany, and Piwo Kushle Mnyandu in Washington. Thank you so much for this absolutely fascinating conversation. I do appreciate your insights and your time. Well, here's some reaction to another question we asked on social media. What kind of reparations would you like to see take effect in your country? John Agaba from Uganda says infrastructure development, such as roads and fast trains connecting east to west, north to south, that will go a long way to change the lives of the people whose ancestors faced these atrocities by colonial governments. Katakie Evans Osei Wusu from Ghana also answered this one and wants reparations targeted at providing housing. And James Mbiri believes the money from reparations will help entrench the homegrown ruling class, who in his views are worse than the colonialists and slave traders combined. Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, the fierce debate on critical race theory and why Americans are so divided over what history children should learn in schools. We'll explain it all when we come back. Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. The United States recently got a new holiday. It's called Juneteenth, commemorating the end of slavery in America. And while many celebrated the historic moment, another debate has been brewing over what and whose history should be taught in American schools. Here again is VOA's Mariama Diallo with more.
Across America, people have celebrated Juneteenth or Freedom Day every year since June 19, 1865. Kelly Elaine Navies is a museum specialist and oral historian at the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington.
On June 19, 1865, General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, with a force of 1,800 Union troops, many of whom were actually United States colored troops, and announced General Order 3, stating that the enslaved were now free. This was important because although the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed on January 1st, 1863, that really only impacted states in the Confederacy and then only states where there was a Union presence.
Navy says that when she was a child, her father, who was an educator, made it a tradition to celebrate Juneteenth.
He would invite not just his students at Berkeley High School, but he would also invite his friends and family and members of the community, barbecuing all hours of the night. from a young age. My job was to chop onions and potatoes. And we would have a program that was intergenerational. Children would perform and read poetry, create dances, an open mic. Elders would speak and share stories of their experiences with being Black in America.
Juneteenth has been a state holiday in nearly all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Last year, in the wake of millions demonstrating against racial injustice after the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others, a bipartisan group tried to get Congress to recognize Juneteenth as a federal holiday. After more than 150 years, Juneteenth was established as the newest federal holiday at a White House ceremony after a bill passed by Congress.
It's a celebration of the emancipation of African Americans who were enslaved, but it's also a day of remembrance. So I'm eager to see not only the Juneteenth holiday be recognized by the federal government, but I'm eager to see how it is recognized, how it is celebrated, how it is used as a tool of education for people, and how it can ultimately bring us more in line with what the hope of emancipation was, which is freedom for everybody. I think it can be a positive development for good for all of us.
But Justin Hansford, law professor at Howard University, also noted the dichotomy between what happened in Washington and current events in the state of Texas.
On the same day that Juneteenth was passed in the Senate, the state of Texas, where Juneteenth originates from, passed a law banning the teaching of the 1619 Project, banning critical race theory, banning the opportunity to teach about Black history. So it's almost like a joke where you pass a proclamation recognizing an important moment in Black history. And at the same time, on the same day, the state where that particular incident took place is passing a law banning the teaching of Black history.
HB 3979 is sponsored by Texas State Representative Steve Toth, who said in an interview with the National Review, the facts are very clear, very explicit. We don't ban, we don't discourage the discussion of anything. But Hansford says it's important to understand there is a connection between Juneteenth and the banning of certain teachings.
Don't forget that the Juneteenth story is a story about Black people who were free, but the knowledge of their freedom, the awareness of their freedom, was denied to them. And here at the same time, we see that same denial of access to information and the denial of access to knowledge being written into law in the state of Texas, the state of Florida, and other states that are passing these anti-critical race theory laws.
Critical race theory, according to Hansford, is a field of study that seeks to uncover the way that race played a central role in how American society is structured. While debated by academics since the 1970s, it has only recently become a political issue.
This is a deliberate plan to politicize and whitewash history.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Stop it.
Florida's Board of Education banned the theory from its public schools.
I think it'll cause people to think of themselves more as a member of a particular race or based on skin color rather than based on the content of their character.
And in Leesburg, Virginia, a rally against critical race theory teaching. Activist Patty Manders opposes anti-racism teaching that she believes trains white children to see themselves as oppressors. But while school curriculum is a lightning rod for controversy, a Juneteenth federal holiday has become law.
The bill is passed.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Join me for the next Straight Talk Africa. We'll look at the human experience of refugees. Can those who have escaped disaster and conflict be made to return to the place they fled in the first place? And what happens between those who leave their home countries and those who stay behind? We'll also bring you a VOA special report on the lives of refugees around the world. So join me for that on the next Straight Talk Africa. And do look out for our question on social media about that subject. We would love to hear from you. And you can, of course, find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, as well as the VOA News website. From the Straight Talk Africa team, thank you for joining us from across Africa and other parts of the world. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.